wished I was a mole in the ground. No, I wished I was a mole in the ground. And if I was a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wished I was a mole in the ground. Oh, wished I was a midrash in the spring. No, I wished I was a midrash in the spring. If I was a midrash in the spring, then I'd make that Torah sing. Oh, wished I was a midrash in the spring. Oh, wished I was a book in a library. Oh, I wished I was a book in a library. If I was a book in a library, then I'd finally be free. Oh, wished I was a book in a library.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is just after 9 a.m. on April 6th, 2026. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The Old Mole brings you news, reviews, interviews, and analysis from a radical perspective. We dig at the roots of social issues using tools of feminism, anarchism, Marxism, and earth-based wisdom. We promote radical, systemic, social transformation driven by workers and communities using their material powers of body and mind, wielded collectively and democratically, to change the world. To start today's show, we'll hear Well-Read Red, Patricia Kohlberg, read an article from Common Dreams by Sarah Van Gelder about the forgotten history of U.S.-backed regime change in 1950s Iran as retaliation to the democratically elected prime minister's plans to nationalize oil production. After that, we'll hear a piece from the archives by Clayton Morgridge on the 1860s abolition of slavery seen as a revolution against property that remains incomplete to this day. Finally, today is one of the last of the 8-day Jewish holiday of Pesach, or Passover, when it is traditional to hold a ceremonial meal called a Seder to ritualistically remember the Jewish experience of slavery and liberation from it in ancient Egypt. Whether considered myth, legend, or history, it's a story that's been retold for thousands of years. It's one of the oldest examples of what wobbly troubadour Utah Phillips called the long memory. So to round out today's show, I'll be talking with Mar Zusman about the themes, messages, and contradictions of the Pesach story, how Jews and non-Jews alike have drawn on it to promote revolution and abolition, and how ritual and ceremony could be part of creating liberation and being liberated. You can listen to or share today's show or its segments at kboo.fm/oldmole. We are but a part of listener-supported KBOO Community Radio, whose volunteer-driven production you can support and shape by becoming a member via kboo.fm/donate. Before we turn to Patricia Kohlberg on Iran, we're going to hear a song by Jesse Wells to lead us in. I got to see Jesse in concert a few weeks ago, and it was quite a privilege. We'll hear a few more of his catchy, poetic, and incisive songs throughout the show.
Sometimes you get at your B2s and go bomb Iran. Sometimes you get at your B2s. It's all part of God's plan. Well, if you want that peace, you can't be quiet when there's a picture of you hanging out on an island. So you best be getting your B2s and go bomb Iran. Politicians and preachers get hard as a bone, talking holy war, it's two birds, one stone. Get your Ted Cruz's and your Huckabees. Somebody said old Lindsey Graham free. Flip Miss Tulsi, get the war machine rolling. Where it's gonna stop ain't nobody knowing. So sometimes you get at your B2s and go bomb Iran. Sometimes you get at your B2s. It's all part of God's plan. Well, bomb them to hell. Every boy and every girl be the change in the regime you wanna see in the world. Sometimes you get at your B2s and go bomb Iran. Bomb them to hell. Beat all the thugs, that Palantir's one hell of a drug. Government contractors salivating, there's real good money and liberation. Same playbook as 2003, looks familiar to you, looks familiar to me. Sometimes you get at your B2s and go bomb Iran.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your Well-Read Red, with an article about the history of the U.S.-Iran relationship. The corporate media likes to start this history with the overthrow of the Shah Reza Pahlavi in 1979, which conveniently renders the animosity of Iranians toward America as something mysterious. But if you go back further in time, you will find a very good reason for that Iranian animus. I'm going to share with you excerpts from an article titled "The Price of Not Knowing: Iran Corporate Interests and America's Cycle of Violence." The article by Sarah Van Gelder was published in Common Dreams on March 11, 2026. A link to the full article is available on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. Here's what Van Gelder writes. Why did the United States help topple a democratic government in Iran some 70 years ago? And how did that decision create the conditions we're seeing today? A good place to start would be by asking, how did Iran become our enemy in the first place? To understand how Iran became an adversary, we return to the decision made by the United States and Great Britain to overthrow Iran's Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. Few Americans know this history. In Iran, though, it is remembered as the moment when the United States claimed the country's petroleum wealth for itself and crushed a democratic government that sought to make life better for ordinary people. Mossadegh was the sort of leader the U.S. should have loved. He was anti-communist at a time when containing the Soviet Union was the paramount U.S. foreign policy aim. He pursued reforms that expanded the rights of women and the political and economic conditions of the poor. He was widely respected internationally and was named Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1951. His fatal crime in the eyes of Western powers was nationalizing Iran's oil production, which had been controlled by the British-owned Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. For British and U.S. leaders, a sovereign nation asserting control over its own resources rather than bowing to a foreign corporation was intolerable. The intelligence agencies of the two nations launched a campaign to destabilize the Mossadegh government with media disinformation, targeted bribery, harassment, lies to religious and political leaders, and orchestrated riots. Finally, in 1953, Mossadegh was overthrown in a coup backed by the CIA and Britain's M16. The Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was restored to power. The government outlawed Mossadegh's National Front and arrested most of its leaders. The SAVAK secret police force conducted widespread repression. Over 130,000 were arrested and thousands were tortured and executed. The Shah's policies furthered the wealth and landownings of his own family and friends, while many farmers couldn't get access to land and were forced to migrate to cities and live in shanty towns. Yet the U.S. built warm relations with the new regime as U.S. corporations gained control of 40% of the country's oil fields, along with access to much of the remaining output. By the late 1970s, however, resentment toward the Shah's authoritarian rule exploded into revolution. In 1979, the Shah was overthrown and the Islamic Republic was born. From that moment on, relations between Washington and Tehran were marked by mistrust, hostility, and periodic confrontation. But the overthrow of Mossadegh was not an isolated episode. The United States has a long history of undermining governments that put their own citizens ahead of U.S. economic interests. In 1954, the CIA helped engineer the overthrow of Guatemala's elected president, Jacobo Arbenz. His crime? Land reforms that would have given poor farmers opportunities for a livelihood. The result of the coup was a series of dictatorships. Political opponents, labor union leaders, farmers, and human rights activists were imprisoned, disappeared, and executed. Land reform was reversed and poverty deepened. 2 decades later, the United States helped destabilize the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile, culminating in the U.S.-supported military coup in 1973, led by Augusto Pinochet. The resulting dictatorship led to the death of some 3,000 Chileans, economic policies that brought about cuts in the safety net, a massive buildup in military spending, and high unemployment, while international mining companies were permitted to extract enormous profits from subsequent mining operations. The pattern is unmistakable. When governments around the world pursue policies perceived as threatening U.S. corporate interests, Washington all too often resorts to clandestine interference or military attacks. Wars are often described as tragic inevitabilities, conflicts that somehow spiral beyond anyone's understanding. In reality, we set up the next war when we fail to reckon with choices made in previous conflicts that created instability, oppression, abuses, poverty, and resentment. There are lots of players in this game. Well-connected corporations who insist on military support for their control of resources abroad, even when this means undermining another country's sovereignty, economy, and political stability. Political leaders who put Americans in uniform in harm's way and spend trillions in taxpayer dollars to support corporate interests abroad. Apologists for violence abroad who generate anti-communist, anti-Islamic, or other propaganda. Media outlets that repeat official narratives without scrutiny and downplay the harms caused by U.S. foreign policy choices, especially when those impacted are of different races or religions. Defense contractors who profit from excessive military spending, and U.S. citizens who buy the war propaganda, look away from the suffering, and disregard the reasons refugees may be fleeing the chaos and violence. Some may claim ignorance, and others may argue that they are powerless to intervene, but history suggests that silence and complacency can be powerful enablers of atrocities. A majority of Americans disapprove of the U.S. bombing of Iran, according to a CNN poll taken immediately following the launch of the war, but it will take more than passive disapproval to stop yet another war of choice. Reckoning with the abuses of the powerful and naming those profiting from the willful blindness in the face of atrocities are first steps toward ending the cycles of violence. An informed public, asking questions and refusing complicity, is the first step to stopping this and future wars of choice. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been reading excerpts from an article by Sarah Van Gelder. A link to the full article is published online at the webpage for this show on kboo.fm.
Well, there's a bloated, inefficient, bureaucratic mass run by a mediocre soldier, quasi-general, lasts a diabolical office of death and waste run by a weakened anchor with a desperate rage. The big black hole, $1 trillion deep, funneling money to the Pentagon welfare queens. You got your Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and the list keeps going. Now a government contract keeps the salary high, the quality low, the competition light. The Doge looked funny. What did you expect? Elon was getting a check for the old SpaceX. They're making tanks and guns, software to spy. You know, Tomahawk missiles just Werther's original for an empire in decline. Murdering people from a distance with a hellfire rocket. $250,000 a pop out of the people's pocket. Folks back home are sick, getting sicker. Hey, Pete, bomb the poor in the South. The deal. A whole lot quicker. If you're feeling inadequate, a little bit small, give your big boy order. Kill them all, kill them all. The DOD, the DOW, you can call it whatever you want. War is a racket, no matter how you stack it. Make a treasure in gold out of poor man's blood. Revolving doors, campaign name contributions, writing congressman checks for policy influence. And if you lose your seat, buddy, don't get blue. The lobby that bought you got an office for you. They appeal to your morals, appeal to your fear. Say, folks far away are a threat to you here. There's a malignant tumor in our nation's guts. Our own Department of Defense is a threat to us. The DOD, the DOW, you can call it whatever you want. War is a racket, no matter how you stack it, making treasure and gold out of poor man's blood. Those who take the meat from the table teach contentment. Those for whom the contribution is destined demand sacrifice. Those who eat their fill speak to the hungry of wonderful times to come. Those who lead the nation into the abyss call ruling too difficult for ordinary men. When rulers speak of peace, the common folk know war is coming. When rulers curse war, the mobilization orders have already been written out. The war which is coming is not the first one. There were others like it before. When the last one came to an end, there were conquerors and the conquered. Among the conquered, the common people starved. Among the conquerors, the common people starved too. General, your tank is a powerful vehicle. It can smash through forests and crush 100 men, but it has one defect. It needs a driver. General, your bomber is powerful. It can fly faster than a storm and carry more than an elephant, but it has one defect. It needs a mechanic. General, man is a powerful tool. He can fly and he can kill, but he has one defect. He can think.
And that's exactly what we aim to encourage in you and everyone listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. We just heard Jesse Wells reciting a poem by anti-fascist Marxist playwright Bertolt Brecht called War Primer, and before that, playing his own 2026 song, Department of War. To start today's show off, we heard well-read Patricia Kohlberg reading a piece about the forgotten U.S. regime change in Iran in the 1950s when democratically elected governments sought to nationalize oil production. That piece also ended with classical Persian music on the Santur by Tuhid Ghassemi. Later in the show, we'll hear an interview about the Jewish holiday of Passover, which is right now, and the ancient experience of liberation from slavery it commemorates. Up next, in this spirit, we're going to hear a piece from the Old Mole Archives read by Clayton Morgeridge connecting the abolition of slavery in American history to the revolution against property and capital themselves.
The guiding star of political action, from the Old Mole's point of view, is the democratic control and ownership of the wealth and resources required to produce our lives. That is, everything that falls under the heading of capital. Pretty much all of this capital is now, directly or indirectly, under the control of the wealthiest tenth of the top 1% of the population, or in the U.S., about 320,000 people. It is their interest in maintaining and expanding their power that dictates what the rest of us have to do, how we have to work in order to live. Genuinely radical political action always aims at chipping away at and eventually abolishing the power of the capitalist class and the basis of that power, the private ownership of capital. The goal is a world in which we all together decide how we shall live. This is what revolution is, fundamental change in the relations of property, and therefore of the conditions of labor. Now, to appreciate what it takes to make such a revolution, it is worth looking back at what has been called the Second American Revolution, the Civil War, and the abolition of slavery. With the end of the war and the passage of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the right to own human beings as property was abolished. The result was that what had been property, almost 4 million enslaved people, valued at over $3 billion, or 18% of the total of all U.S. wealth, suddenly ceased to be property, and all that wealth vanished from the economy. This was a revolution more radical than the first one of 1776 because it worked a fundamental change in property relations. Let's look back at the debate over slavery and the principle of private property in the decades leading up to the Civil War. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution declares that no one can be deprived of their property without due process of law. Now, did that mean that the nation could not deprive enslavers of their property in human beings? Did it mean government could not prohibit moving slaves into new territories? The main issue in the 1830s and 40s was whether the government had the right to stop the expansion of slavery into new territories by admitting new states to the Union as free states. Those who profited from slavery, not only those who owned and drove enslaved people in the South, but the many northern investors in slaves and cotton, knew that slavery could only thrive if it kept expanding to keep up with the world market in cotton. Abolitionists and others who opposed slavery also understood this and hoped to end it by confining it to where it already existed and by repealing the laws that required northern officials to return escaped slaves to their enslavers. In 1836, abolitionists were calling for Congress to use its power over federal territory to end the slave trade and even to ban slavery itself in the District of Columbia. Here is how the South responded, as described by historian Edward Baptist in his book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun responded to these anti-slavery demands with a speech that outlined a foundational idea. He told the Senate that the Fifth Amendment limited federal power over individuals' property by decreeing that no one could be deprived of his property without due process of law. Calhoun now proceeded to build a sweeping principle on the back of this sentence. Due process, he insisted, could mean only trial by jury of a specific criminal. What the abolitionists proposed was the opposite of due process. Legislative fiat that erased the property claims of a whole class of people. And, said Calhoun, were not the slaves of this district property, and were not their enslavers a whole class of property owners? Presumably, Congress could not prevent people from buying or selling said property, since salability is usually one of property's characteristics. Baptist goes on, Calhoun was stating an idea that would eventually be known as the doctrine of substantive due process. The due process requirements to which the Constitution referred could not be fulfilled simply by passing a law, for a law that invaded the rights of property owners ran up against something too fundamental for procedure to alter. In Calhoun's vision, the Fifth Amendment was a geological outcropping that confirmed that beneath the Constitution lay an underlying substantive tectonic plate of natural law that allowed owners to hold and use property. Now, in 1847, Calhoun went on to argue that the Fifth Amendment denied Congress any right to require that new states outlaw slavery, complaining, quote, resolved, that the enactment of any law which should directly or by its effects deprive the citizens of any of the states of this Union from emigrating with their property into any of the territories of the United States would unjustly discriminate between citizens of slave states and citizens of free states, and would therefore be a violation of the Constitution. He implied that the federal government should actually pass laws to enact the institution of slavery on federal territory, for to do otherwise would be to deprive individual slave owners and indeed all Southern whites, who were, after all, potential property owners, of their rights to emigrate with their property. End of quote. Well, it took a civil war and a constitutional amendment to remove human beings from the category of private property and free them from the direct ownership of capital. But capital still owns and controls the wealth enslaved people created, and it continues to expropriate that so-called free labor today and to dictate the conditions of labor and life. To protect the rights of capital, the principle of substantive due process, protecting private property that was laid down by Calhoun, is very much with us today. As Edward Baptiste writes, after the Civil War, pro-big business legal thinkers from the North would, ironically enough, take up a version of Calhoun's idea. From the 1890s through the New Deal era, the Supreme Court repeatedly used substantive due process to strike down legislative attempts to regulate Gilded Age industry, protect workers' rights, or break up monopolies. Substantive due process shaped and continues to shape the political economy of the United States in enduring ways. End of quote. A good case can be made that reparations should be paid to the descendants of slaves for the wealth that was beaten and sweated out of them. But the wealth owned and controlled by the very wealthiest families rules our world to the extent that a recent study of political power concluded that the U.S. is a plutocracy. Expropriating that wealth and putting it in public hands, that is the next revolution. Abolishing the private ownership of human beings was not easy. Neither will be the abolition of private property in the wealth our labor creates. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Okay, I wrote this song for a Jewish climate rally, and I rewrote it for labor notes. Any Jews in the crowd? Very well represented at a labor conference. Okay, so... it's getting warmer across the whole planet, and the waters are rising, goddammit, and parts of the country will be under the sea, creating wars of destruction for our children to be. And the worst part is that we've known the whole time our leaders betrayed us for pennies, nickels, dimes, and all we've got now are statements that are vague. God, we've found our pharaohs, now where are the plagues? And Mirvaln Zeiber Leben, oh Mirvaln Zeiber Leben, Mirvaln Zeiber Leben, we will outlive them, we will survive. Meanwhile, your rent is still coming, and the landlord won't fix the stove or the plumbing. The hospitals will kill you if you can't pay, and the government will throw you in prison for the rest of your days. Our pharaohs will tell you all about sustainability and compromise. Please don't forget the civility. But the UN is saying we've got less than 20 years, and that change will require some billionaires' tears. And Mirvaln Zeiber Leben, oh Mirvaln Zeiber Leben, Mirvaln Zeiber Leben, we will outlive them, we will survive. It's easy to get hopeless thinking about the situation. You know, the end of the days creates quite the complications. With lives being lost, wind knocking down the doors, it's worth remembering that we've seen horrors before. There's an old tale about some Jews caught by the Nazis. They're back against the wall, not a way out that they could see. The Jews were requested to dance before they were dead. Well, one stepped forward, and here's what he said. He said, Mirvaln Zeiber Leben. He said, Mirvaln Zeiber Leben. He said, Mirvaln Zeiber Leben. We will outlive them. We will survive. As the bombs getting dropped kill another few million, and the genocidal profiteers who are doped by the billions will step forward, stand up, we won't be afraid. We'll move forward proudly, we're courageous and brave. Yeah, we'll build out a union and sing out this chorus. We'll shut down their factories so they can't ignore us. No one to save us but you and me. Yeah, we'll fight and we'll strike until we part the sea. Yeah, we'll build out a union union and sing out this chorus. We'll shut down their factories so they can't ignore us. No one to save us but you and me. I will fight and we'll strike until we part the sea. Mir Valen Zeiber Leben, Mir Valen Zeiber Leben, Mir Valen Zeiber Leben. We will outlive them, we will survive. Solidarity forever. Yeah, we'll fight and strike and part the sea.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That was a recording of Ben Moss Horowitz singing an original song based on a real phrase and events from World War II at the 2022 Labor Notes Conference Great Labor Arts Exchange Concert, which I was present for. It's become something of a holiday song we play in our house during Passover. To that end, today is the fifth day of Passover, or Pesach, one of the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar. As a story, it's about the ancient Jewish experience of slavery in Egypt and liberation from it. A central Passover tradition is the Seder, a ceremonial retelling of the story through words, song, and eating ritual food before a festive meal. It has not only been a core part of Judaism for thousands of years, but it has been an inspiration of freedom struggles in recent generations. My partner Mar, who is Jewish, has not only been to several more typically private seders, including ones we host, but has helped organize public seders through Jewish Voice for Peace in the spirit of Rabbi Arthur Waskow's 1969 Freedom Seder. So I wanted to have them on to talk about the Passover story in light of Jewish anti-Zionism, seder traditions, and working toward freedom and liberation for all peoples. Thanks for joining me, Mar.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Well, before we jump into our conversation, could you say a bit about your story coming into a renewed Jewish identity through anti-Zionism, what Seders or Pesach have meant to you, and how that connects with what JVP is doing now?
So my parents were immigrants from the Soviet Union in the late 70s, so they grew up quite secular and immigrated to Brooklyn, and that's when I was born. And they were fairly alienated from the Jewish community in New Jersey, which is where I mostly grew up, partly because of the dues structure of synagogues. They were working class and immigrants. And then when I began at university, it was when I really started learning about the Palestine. I just had not known really anything about the struggles that Palestinians faced and the ongoing apartheid conditions in Israel. And that just really turned me off to Judaism even more, especially also being a woman at that time and having a queer identity. Just really had been turned off from Judaism. And it wasn't until about 2020 or 2021, through a series of classes that I took with Rain Crow, who is a local priestess and teacher. She teaches a series of classes, one on Caliban and the Witch, or The Burning Times Never Ended, and this class called Longing to Belong. And that was one of the first times that I was with a group of anti-Zionist Jews. And it was a really profound experience for me. I had always considered myself a spiritual person and felt this call from my ancestors that there was still something within Judaism for me to explore. And so I got involved with our Reconstructionist synagogue here in Portland, and I began meeting other anti-Zionist Jews. And then I got involved with Jewish Voice for Peace at the beginning of 2024. And I would say that all along throughout the early part of my life, I have always loved Passover because it is the time that we really celebrate freedom and this incredible story from the Exodus. And I think that a lot of people, even if they're not connected with Judaism, really connect with Passover. For one, it's a home holiday. It's one of the only holidays within Judaism that is not part of a synagogue. It's people celebrate it in their homes, and there are lots of kind of interesting things that we do during Passover. And most importantly, for I think a lot of us, getting to celebrate freedom and that experience of liberation is pretty impactful.
You mentioned, you know, there's many different parts to Passover and to the Seder itself. Could you say a bit about what the Seder is, what goes into it? It's part ritual, part meal, part storytelling, but it's been happening in a pretty consistent way for thousands of years. What are the main highlights of the Seder?
Yeah, so Seder actually means order. So there are lots of different things that happen, but some of the important ones are we drink wine. We have four cups. Wine, I think, really does represent like coming together, expressing gratitude for the fruit of the vine, and just kind of relaxing into a space of family and community. But I guess what I'll say, first of all, before I get even more into all the different parts, I think what really makes it a Seder is that we tell the story of the Exodus, and we have to tell it as if it is us living through slavery and living through the experience of being liberated. A crucial part of any Seder is that it's multi-generational. We tell this story to our children. There are lots of parts of the Seder that appeal specifically to children. And we eat matzah. You know, the story with the matzah is that our people were in such a rush to leave Egypt, which we call Mitzrayim, kind of the narrow place. We're leaving the narrow place, and we had to do it in such a hurry that we didn't have time for the dough to rise. So the matzah baked flat, and it is a reminder of that moment. And so with all of the ritual foods, the reason why we eat them and prepare them and display them in that way is because we really do want to experience what it was like. You know, we eat that dry cracker-like matzah, and we dip the parsley. The parsley sort of represents spring, which is the time that Passover comes in, and we dip parsley in salt water to remember the tears of our ancestors. And we have that experience of eating bitter foods and sort of unpleasant, dry, salty, bitter foods to help us feel in our bodies what that experience might have been like for our ancestors. And we tell the story, and every family has their own different traditions for telling it and how what parts they highlight. But oftentimes there's some theatricality involved, like props or acting things out or having an opportunity to just discuss the different parts of the Exodus story and reflect on them, and especially think about how we still are, in some ways, experience the loss of freedom or experience oppression. So other parts of the Seder include, there's this section where they talk about four different kinds of children, and also the four questions. And so this is one of the parts, like I mentioned, that appeals specifically to children. There's a tradition in many families where the youngest child is supposed to recite the four questions. So there's some preparation involved. There's ritual hand washing. We eat different foods like horseradish, again, to represent the bitterness of slavery. And there's this food called haroset, which is chopped up apples with wine and nuts. And it represents the bricks and the mortar that the Hebrew slaves used to build.
Well, before we get into more of the details about the Seder itself, I'd like to just recap the story of the Exodus. It is part myth and legend with elements of history. The ancient Jews were in Egypt, and their numbers were growing, and the pharaoh at the time, Ramesses II, grew concerned that they would become a powerful constituency. So he had them enslaved. Under enslavement, a prophecy arose that one of them would lead a revolt against the pharaoh. And so the pharaoh had all of the firstborn of the Hebrews killed. The midwives of Egypt, who might have been Jewish, might have been Egyptian, refused to do this and came up with an excuse. Under the cover of that excuse, one of these children was hidden away in the reeds of the Nile River. When Pharaoh's daughter recovered him, he was raised in Pharaoh's court as one of his own, and eventually came to know his identity as one of the Jews, and became disgusted with the slave society that he was born into and was somehow living on top of. And he killed one of the slave drivers and fled, and had a wife with one of the neighboring tribes, and had a calling from God to come back and liberate his people, the so-called burning bush episode. And he came back and he reunited with his family, his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam and his mother Yocheved, and tried to reason with Pharaoh, who refused, and so God sent 10 plagues, and these plagues all have a kind of earthly element, and so they strike, I think, listeners and readers today as kind of foretelling climate change apocalypse, and Pharaoh eventually allows them to leave, and they famously leave through the Reed Sea. Moses parts the sea, and as they escape through it to the other side, Pharaoh follows them and is eventually killed when the sea collapses back in on them. Could you say more about the Freedom Seder, where it comes from, and what it has meant as both a bridge between modern freedom struggles and renewing Jewish practice?
Well, I think what I really would love to talk about is the ways in which people today are taking the Freedom Seder and applying it to their context. So, for example, in at Jewish Voice for Peace, for the last 3 years, we've held a community liberation Seder where we do all of the things that make a Passover Seder, but we invite the community and we bring Palestine to the center of the conversation. And we believe, like so many other radical leftist Jews who spoke up for justice before us, that no one is free unless we're all free. And it is, I think for many of us anti-Zionist Jews, it's incredibly painful to celebrate a holiday that commemorates our freedom and liberation when the state of Israel is committing the atrocities of genocide and so much more in the name of the Jewish people or in the name of Jewish safety. And so that's what me and many other anti-Zionist Jews have committed ourselves to during Passover, is being able to uplift the Palestinian struggle for freedom and tie it in with our own histories of oppression, exploitation, and really uplift this central idea that none of us are free unless we're all free.
In what ways have Jews been innovating and inventing more rituals around the Seder?
One easy example is the additions that people have created on the Seder plate itself, like different ritual objects, different symbols, in ways of including other people that have been marginalized. And I would love to share the story of the orange on the Seder plate. I think it was Susanna Heschel. She was inspired by a group of women from Oberlin College in the early 80s who added, in her story, it was a piece of bread, which is totally not kosher for Passover. My teacher actually was part of that group of women in Oberlin College, and they basically the story went that one of the lesbians in their collective, when she was a teenager, had asked her rabbi, what is the place of for lesbians within Judaism? And he got very angry and said, lesbians belong in Judaism like bread belongs on the Seder plate. But of course, they didn't want to add bread because that would make their whole table trife or not kosher, and so they added something called makom, which is just the space, and it was a space to recognize those who had been marginalized, like the lesbian in their collective. And Susanna Heschel had heard this story and decided to place an orange on the Seder plate to commemorate the incredible contributions that gay and lesbian Jews have given to Judaism. And the way she describes it is, you know, the orange is, you know, as a fruit, it multiplies. And yes, it also has seeds, and that's an opportunity to kind of spit out, you know, the plague of homophobia, so to speak. And that tradition has really spread. I think a lot of Jews now incorporate an orange on the Seder plate to represent LGBTQ people and women and other people with those type of marginalized identities. Those of us in the Palestine Solidarity Movement will add an olive to the Seder plate to represent the olive trees that are so important to the people of Palestine and also have been threatened by settler colonial violence. People have added a tomato to represent the farm workers and to be able to give gratitude to the farm workers and also to speak to the struggles that they have and more generally in the labor movement.
How do you think that this has led to women and queer people being like prominent leaders and champions and drivers of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, as well as other movements for freedom and liberation outside of this context?
I mean, I think women and queer folks and trans people and people with marginalized identities understand oppression, understand exploitation, marginalization. So there's an empathy there. And within Judaism, you know, it's the patriarchy. I mean, it's one of the originals. And so, you know, there is a long history and tradition of women not being included in rituals and anything that where there is, you know, where it's like a sacred act, like a mitzvah. And so it has become over time, you know, another front in the movement for different kinds of liberation. And so there's just a natural, I think, bridge there.
But it isn't just that Israel is still or is oppressing Palestine. It's the empire and Pharaoh in various forms, you know, exists throughout the world. The United States is the great Pharaoh of the world, but not the only one.
Absolutely. I mean, American Jews have this almost like double complicity because supposedly, you know, these atrocities, genocide, and now war in Iran and Lebanon are being committed for Jewish safety and paid for through American taxpayer dollars. And we also see the way that our neighbors here in the U.S. are being impacted by ICE and certainly don't have freedom. Many of our neighbors don't have the freedom to leave their homes without being afraid of being kidnapped. So it is, you know, we're living under this, the boot of empire, you know, in this time of incredible crisis. So to be able to celebrate Passover and to celebrate our liberation, there's really no way to do that without also praying for and uplifting the voices of our neighbors in our community who are who don't have freedom right now, who don't have liberation or safety.
Before we wrap up, how can folks get involved with Palestine-Israel solidarity work or with anti-Zionist Jewish community?
Yeah, there's lots of Palestine solidarity work happening in Portland, depending on how you want to get involved. I work with Jewish Voice for Peace. You can find us online on our website or on Instagram, and you know, shoot us an email, let us know that you want to get involved, and we can support you in getting connected. Also, DSA has a working group, a Palestine Solidarity working group, BDS, which stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions, and there are Palestine groups on different campuses around Portland. So there's also Al-Auda, which is a Palestine-led organization, as well as others. But I think the important thing is just keeping Palestine at the center. It is very, very common to, you know, we saw it during the last election cycle, basically throw this issue under the bus. That is just not a winning strategy. We have to keep, you know, those who are experiencing the most marginalization at the center of our collective struggles for liberation.
Well, that's all the time we have for this conversation. I've been talking with Mar Zusman about the Jewish holiday of Passover and its celebration of freedom from slavery for thousands of years.
See the leaves turning green, and my soul flower starts to groan. No, the stars ain't to blame, but all the same, there must be something that they're out there knowing. New moons and blooms and birds and their tunes. Count me in, mama, count me in, and let me count. I don't know what, but in my gut, I'm gonna find what it's all about. Springtime, springtime. And the bees and the bud and the trees, turtles getting down the path, worms get to wriggle and gaggle, a goose gets to giggle, and smell get around, find a way back, and the frogs and the toads are coming out of their holes, chirping and a burping and a humping along, daffodils chilling, ready and willing to sing, sing, sing that springtime song. Now it's springtime, springtime. God keep a promise. It's spring again. Mother Earth keeps her word now. The woman is honest. The puppies, paint the Easter eggs, geometric patterns and rings like Saturn, pastel, yellow, blues, and reds. And this summer in the garden, I'm gonna find out what it means. In between the green beans, taters, and tomatoes, and sweet peas, springtime, springtime. Don't God keep a promise? It's spring again. Mother Earth keeps her word now. The woman is honest.
That was Springtime by the recently four-time Grammy-nominated folk singer Jesse Wells. Before that, I was talking with Mar Zusman, an activist with Jewish Voice for Peace, about the meaning of Passover. And one thing we forgot to mention is that Passover is also about springtime and rebirth. There is even traditionally an egg on the Seder plate that represents the fecundity of the season and the taboo topic of sex, but also the promise of life after the bleakness of winter, which we are meant to connect with the dark times of slavery and class society. Well, that's it for our show. Thank you to Patricia Kohlberg for reading Sarah Van Gelder's piece about the forgotten history of regime change in Iran. Thank you to Mar Zusman for our discussion about Passover and celebrating its ancient story of freedom from slavery. And the memory of our old mole Clayton Morgridge is always a blessing, who we heard from also about freedom from slavery and the revolution against capitalism. You can listen to today's show in the next few days at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can email the Old Mole with your questions or ideas for the show at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Tune in every week from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays for news, reviews, interviews, and analysis from the Old Mole's radical perspective.
Spring again. Don't cut people on this. It's spring again. Mother Earth is a word now. The woman is honest.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.